The Marion Finucane Show on RTE Radio 1 with Hyundai. Now offering 5 years free servicing on every new 142 Hyundai. Ireland's fastest growing car brand.
Welcome back to the programme. Now, a caller was on to say, just wishing your guest Steve Collins and his family the best of luck. Well done to Mr. Collins. And yes, he should come back to his homeland, no matter what it costs the state to get Mr. Collins and his family home safely and to remain safe always. Good luck and what a good man. I believe good always overcomes evil. Well, now, the only thing I can say to you about that is what you'd really mean is that you hope good will always overcome evil. But I think realistically, given the personnel that we were dealing with, well, not we were dealing with, but the Gardaí and most particularly the Collins family were dealing with, it was considered for his safety that he should go away. And as he described, things being organised and conversations in prisons and 500,000 to kill a man, I mean... Anyway, I hope you're right, caller, when you say you believe good always overcomes evil. Let us hope you're right. Anyway, on the subject of refereeing, hi, Marion. I was pitchforked into refereeing a hurling game when I was 16 years old. An All-Ireland referee present advised me that the referee should be the fittest person on the field and should take control of the game in the first 30 seconds, and that if you have to send a player to the line, you have lost control. Oh, that's a bit unfair. The greatest abuse I ever got as a referee was in a school's game, a girls' school's football match at that, says our caller. And a reminder, of course, for all that Dublin is playing Meath tomorrow in the Leinster football final. So good luck to all involved, including the referee, for that match, let it be said. Now, big event next weekend. It's 100 years on from the Asgard. How much of you do you remember from what you learned in school history about the Asgard? We kind of knew it as a sail training facility that we had, and Asgard 2 that went down and all that kind of thing. But next weekend we will be recalling the gun-running trip, the Asgard, and its crew of Erskine and Molly Childers and Mary Spring Rice that they made in July in 1914, bringing a cargo of guns bought from the Germans to arm the Irish Volunteers. It sometimes became known as the Ireland's Boston Tea Party. But have a listen to this, and this is De Valera in 1961 on the return of the Asgard.
This is a splendid day, a glorious day, and a joyful day for all of us. We are grateful to the government for having secured for us, for the nation, the Asgard. 47 years ago, this boat first came here. In the light of the freedom we enjoy, we salute all those who in any measure had a share in bringing that freedom to us. And in particular here, we salute Mrs. Childers, Mary Spring Rice, Erskine Childers, and all who were crew of the Asgard. Banacht de Oriv Galeir.
And that was Eamon De Valera in 1961. Well, I'm joined in studio now by Nessa Childers, MEP, granddaughter of Erskine and Molly Childers, and also Kay Sheehy, a producer who's here that has been researching the archives in RTE and reading the logs of Molly Childers and Mary Spring Rice in the National Library. Nessa, first of all, you're both very welcome. Nessa, tell us a little bit about your grandparents, your grandmother and your grandfather.
Well, yes, it's a kind of an unusual story in many ways. My grandfather was born in England, and I think the crucial part of his his life that started all of this in many ways was that he was separate. His father died of tuberculosis, and for some reason they thought that his mother was in danger of getting it as well, and he was actually separated at the age of six from his own mother and taken to Glendalough House in Ireland. And you know, everything was very pleasant there with his aunts, etc. But I always feel, and some others, that I think that he kind of reacted to that by thinking of Ireland almost as his home in a very emotionally powerful way. And that's how it began, as well as the politics. It's never just the politics.
I know.
It's always other things.
Yeah. And your grandmother?
Yes, she was the daughter of a Boston physician, and his wife grew up in you know, a kind of upper middle class family in Boston, and she had a lot of suffering too. She was paralysed by an accident and was 12 years almost unable to move, and was, I think, for most of her life was in pain, though she never spoke about it. And she couldn't go to school, so she was educated in other ways, and again I think that drove her. You know, she had a very strong, she died when I was seven, but I remember her vaguely. She had a very strong personality and was very determined, if you like, not to remain in that position. So you
right.
can imagine someone on a boat, you know, who could hardly walk.
Right, yeah. Well, the funny thing about the boat, and I'll come to UK in a second, this was a gift, a wedding gift.
Yeah.
Nice little wedding gift. But your grandfather was from her father, the husband, i.e. your grandfather, was very careful about the design.
Yes, he designed it with her in mind, which, you know, for with her disability in mind, which I'd say was probably quite unusual in those days, you know, to design anything with the idea that someone being on it is disabled.
Yeah, right? Yeah. So that's how that came about. And I want to get to some of the other bits that we want to come to. Kay, how did they come politically active?
Well, what's happening at the time is it's 1914 and the Liberal government are bringing in the Home Rule Act. But there is resistance in Ireland from the Ulster Volunteers. They've armed themselves through the Larne gun running. And there's also a feeling from the Irish Volunteers, who are pro-Home Rule, that they can't trust the British Army in Ireland because there's been the Curragh Mutiny. So they feel if the Ulster Volunteers can arm themselves, so should they. So then a group of mainly Protestant and Anglo-Irish people, Roger Casement, Mary Spring Rice from Mount Trenchard in the Monteagle Estate in County Limerick, Alice Stopford Green, who is Anglo-Irish from Meath, she lives in London, and they all meet in London with the Childers and they decide, let's arm the volunteers. So this is to protect Home Rule, really. So Erskine Childers and this guy called Darrell Figgis, who's a writer who lives in Ackle, they go to Germany. They buy 1,500 guns and the ammunition to go with it. Old Mauser guns that I think subsequently were used in the 1916 Rising, and Pierce gave out about them, that when they shot, so much smoke came off that you couldn't disguise the fact of who was shooting the gun. What they decide to do is they buy the guns.
Where'd they get the money?
They got the money. Alice Stopford Green, this woman, had money.
Right.
So she gave half the money. Mary Spring Rice and Darrell Figgis raised the rest. So it was very much either through their connections or through their own private wealth.
Right.
So they had the guns, then they had to deliver them. So the idea was that Darrell Figgis would go and on a tug meet up in the North Sea with Erskine Childers, who would use the Asgard, the yacht that they got as the wedding present, and Mary Spring Rice's cousin, Conor O'Brien, equally had a yacht called the Kelpie. So there was two yachts, 1,500 guns, and they were to rendezvous on the North Sea.
Right, and what happened?
Well, the wonderful thing that exists is there are logs. Damn. There's a log written by Mary Spring Rice, and then there's a wonderful letter written by Molly to Alice Stopford Green that really details the journey. And they've great personalities. It comes out in them. So they're there in Holyhead, and they have the Childers, there's Mary Springrice, and there's they've got one Gola fisherman from Donegal. His name is Pat McGinley. Mm-hmm. And he's been told to come over to Holyhead because you've always wanted, by a mutual friend of Erskine Childers, because you've always wanted to go in a yacht. So Pat McGinley talked to Nessa's half-brother, Rory Childers, back in the 60s, and this is how he describes what he thought he was up for and what happened.
No idea.
Yes.
I thought it was going to be a nice yacht ride.
You thought it was going to be a nice yacht ride,
yeah.
I see.
Thought it was.
Well, when you finally departed, did you have any other mate with you?
No, when I departed, he had a fella in there first, and I didn't like him very much because I could see that he wasn't a seaman to start with.
I see.
And then Mr. Childers asked me if I knew anybody, a good deep-seafaring man that could know how to handle a boat.
Yes.
I said, yes, I got him. It took him almost a week to get there. I don't know what held him up. And Mr. Childers, he was getting anxious, you know, because it was getting late. And he wanted to get going. So he told us to hoist up anchor with the same hull that it was on, you know, and get ready. So when we had the anchor almost up, I looked across the beach and I seen my buddy coming down with a sea bag over his shoulder. And I told him, Mr. Childers, that's him over there. Lower down the anchor again, he says, and take this fella out and take your buddy in here, he says.
Right, I was talking to your brother, obviously. Now, Molly said in her letter to Alice about Charles Duggan.
Yes, she said Charles Duggan turned up smiling. So he's there, like your man says, yes, describes, with his bag over. Now, the women tell a different story, because even though there was McGinley, but there was a young greenhorn from, yes, the volunteer, one of the Irish volunteers, was sent to be part of the crew.
Right.
And he was useless. He didn't know one end of a rope for the other, but the women fell in love with him. So when Charles Duggan arrives, this is the second fella,
yeah,
from Gola, he says, you know, what joy that we have a boatman, but it broke their heart when the greenhorn left,
yes,
them. So there's all that kind of colour.
There's a very funny piece where Mary Spring Rice said that the greenhorn was full of silent Sinn Féin enthusiasm, but didn't know one piece of a rope from another, basically. And I really actually recognise what that's like, because you get that in political movements. The older members are slightly sort of almost amused at the very intense beliefs of the younger ones.
Enthusiasm.
But in this case, he didn't know anything about ropes.
Right, okay.
So, Marion, the two men, Charles Duggan and Pat McGinley, are on board, the two Gola fishermen.
Yeah.
They think they're going for a trip on a yacht. So it's not until they're in the North Sea that Erskine decides to have a chat with them.
The next morning, about 4 o'clock, we hear the thump, thump, thump up on deck, you know. And here was Mr. Childers getting us up, you know, and hoist up anchor and start out. So we started out into the North Sea, and that's the first time that I knew it wasn't going to be a nice yacht ride.
What did he say?
He says, boys, we are going over to the German side to pick up a cargo rifles for the Irish volunteers, and if we were good and made good, we'd be pretty well rewarded for it. That's the yacht ride.
Mm-hmm. That was to be the yacht ride.
Yeah.
So, and in her letter to Alice, Molly describes this as dramatic moment. Erskine told our two hands what they have in mind to run guns. To our delight, they proved willing and good. And in fact, Duggan, Mary Springrice, who used to do Irish lessons on the lawn in Mount Trenchard, she uses Duggan during quiet moments to brush up on her Irish.
Oh, right.
And if they hadn't turned out to be okay on the boat, I think everything was very touch and go in many ways. I mean, you can get a sense from the diaries of the, everybody is seasick at the beginning. I mean, you feel seasick even reading it. And there's a question, can they get to places on time? Can they get to Coas on time? And I can see my grandfather there. My grandmother describes him as being nearly broken down with it all, with all the potential that could go wrong,
yeah,
when he gets better. He was a stickler for punctuality, as was my father. So that must run. He would become apoplectic if things weren't on time. But it was, you know, the chaos and all the transshipping of the guns. Something could have gone wrong. I mean, it really was not an easy
task.
So
right.
This is Pat McGinley, the boatman.
Yeah.
This is his impression of Erskine and Molly.
My impression of him was good, that he was a real good seaman.
A real good seaman. Mm-hmm. And of Mrs. Childers?
And Mrs. Childers was a fine woman. She was a good sailmaker and she was a good nurse.
A good nurse?
Me, see?
Oh, you have a scar there.
A scar there. The loose block hit me there.
I see. And so she patched you up.
She patched me up, took care of it about a week or more, you know, every day, changed bandages on it. And she made a good job.
And as Nessa said, there's always this, you know, compunction to go quicker and quicker, yeah, because waiting for the second Donegal fella has obviously delayed them.
Yeah.
Conor O'Brien is in Cowes waiting for them. So when they arrive, Mary Spring Rice is his cousin, and a torrent of abuse Conor O'Brien gives to Mary Spring Rice, saying, where were you? He's been sending telegrams all over the place saying, where is the Asgard? So they are afraid now. Not only all of Cowes knows, but all of Ireland and England know that they're going to ring.
And there's a fear of things leaking into the Daily Mail. I found that amusing too, because of course people would still be afraid of things leaking into the, but there's just too much information getting out there, largely a result of Conor O'Brien, who was slightly sort of, I don't know, hysterical at that point. So the Daily Mail was a great concern to everybody. Yeah, it would have been serious too.
So they finally get to the North Sea.
Right.
And Rattengan Lightship is the rendezvous point. The Kelpie has already been there, and they hope they're going to take half and half of the 1,500 guns. The Kelpie takes 600. That's all he can carry. So again, they're raging with Conor O'Brien that he has that he's left them with 900 guns. So all the guns, they're wrapped in bales of 10. They're greasy. They're covered in straw. They have to take all the straw off the guns. There's straw everywhere. The guns are greasy. Mary and this guy called Gordon Shepherd, who is a friend of Erskine's and a member of the British Armed Forces.
Yes.
He's downstairs with Mary Spring Rice. Erskine and Molly are in the cabin and they're all loading up the guns. And there's great descriptions of...
Molly has a sentence there. She says, I wish you could have seen the same darkness, lamps, strange faces, the swell of the sea making the boat lurch, guns, straw everywhere, no supper, chocolate thrust into mouths, water handed around, and a German face peered down the hatch saying they will explode if you knock them or drop them. So, and she's actually feeding chocolate, Molly is, to people. That appears in Mary's diaries.
Just to keep them going.
Yes. Yeah. She's actually putting pieces of chocolate into their mouths, but that's a very good description of what it was like.
So they're there for 5 hours, and then of course they have to go back. So they put their mattresses on top of the guns. That's where they sleep. They slept very sound that night because they had been so busy. They say they can't keep a hair grip in their hair because it goes down through the mattress, down through the guns. All their possessions keep falling down through the guns. And then they make their way back. And Pat McGinley is asked again by Rory in this clip, did they spot any danger? Did they spot any danger from British fleets, British army
surveillance? Yeah.
Well, when the fog lifted near the English side of the channel, did you see any warships there, British warships?
Plenty of them. Plenty of warships coming out of every little harbour around the coastline there.
And how did Childers react to this?
Well, he reacted to it. He told us that we'll make a tack out to sea to clear all these boats and dump the ammunition that was stored in the cockpit, you know, that was showing up above with the Dutch writing on it.
I see.
I could read the writing on the boxes that there was an issue.
This was...
We dumped it right out in the north side.
So then there's all kinds of more... There's tension on board, you know, between Shepherd. Shepherd, they say, is a cold water douche at some stage. He always thinks, we'll never get there in time. We'll never do this on time. So the women get a bit fed up of him. And they're always dreaming of something lovely to eat because they're half starved. They've only rudimentary things to eat.
How long are we talking about in all here?
Well, they set out at the beginning of July and they get in on the 26th of July. So is it about 26 days or more?
Yeah. Yes, and they're all always dying to get off the boat any few times and have something to eat or sleep. I think the diet was absolutely, you know, and the attempt to cook food. And one of them talks about cooking three fish that then fall off onto the floor with the oil and, you know, in the middle of a storm and, you know, this type of thing.
And then they arrive in Howth, and that's equally stressful. Yes.
That's one of the most tense parts of the event because of the whole time they were there, because they didn't know that anyone would be there to meet them. They hadn't had any word, I think, from the volunteers for 3 weeks, and they just, everything was by letter, of course, and perhaps it would have been difficult to get word at that stage, but they didn't know that anyone would meet them and come to take the guns, and they thought they could be just sailing into the harbour after all this time with somehow nothing happening. And of course the relief when they saw, they felt then that it was like a dream.
Well, now I know this is your family, yeah, obviously, that we're talking about, and I know that there will be celebrations. Yeah. We'll come back to the story in a second, but in a peculiar way, celebrating it even 100 years now, isn't it glorifying guns?
Yeah, I mean, I'm very aware of that issue. I, you know, and the historical context that it took place in. You could say that, and but if you go back to those moments, you see, they felt it was necessary. You know, my grandfather believed in the freedom of small nations. But here's the interesting thing about this. This was a symbolic act. I don't know whether those guns, how much they took part in actual killings. We know that they did with some. But he was an expert at PR and propaganda. People don't realise this about my grandfather. One of the pictures of Mary Spring Rice and Molly sitting beside guns is quite clearly posed, you know, for those purposes. And he is an expert. And I suppose it's a sensitive issue because, I mean, you can't separate it from all this stuff going around around us at the moment.
Yes.
I mean, there's war everywhere on the front page of newspapers today. And, you know, it makes me concerned about, you know, I think we have to talk about that, about it. But I tell you what I think this was. Some discussion has been going on about the nature of war today, that it's no longer large armies facing themselves across, yeah, battlefields. And somebody described what happens now as armed politics. I think this is an early example of just exactly that, armed politics.
Right.
The guns were used to perhaps scare people of what worse things could happen. And I think you have to see it that way. Right. But it is a controversial issue.
Mm. We've one more.
Yes, yes. What happens then is we switch now. We're on the pier in Howth, and we're with a young boy at the time. He's not on the clip. His name is Billy McConkie, and his job is to tie up the boat.
Well, there was only myself and the brother and my father here, and Tom Kettle originally, the day before, wanted us to go out to fish.
Yes.
And I was told, at least my father was told, that he wasn't going out to fish, he was going out for something else. And I was so young, he wouldn't let me go. So she came in the next morning then, and I cut our ropes here.
What came in, the escort?
The escort, yeah.
Yeah.
And then, in the meantime, there was about 400 or 500 men running down here to unload her, and three taxis.
How old were you then?
I was about 15 and a half.
Yes. And you actually tied up the escort?
I did, yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
Do you remember any other incident at that time?
Yes. I remember Miss Rice and Mrs. Childers with our sandwiches. They had two water bits and a plain slab of chocolate between them.
Food again. Just to remind people, your grandfather was subsequently killed by the state.
Yes, yes.
That's Remind right. people of that.
Well, he was executed for nominally for being in possession of a weapon. There are many people who believe that they executed another 77 people around him, as it were. Many people believe that was because there was an anxiety about, as somebody said, killing an Englishman. That is another violent event, a very violent event that affected many people in my family. You see, everyone has families here. My father was 9 or 10 when the Asgard gun running took place, and that was, you know, that execution was illegal. It was a kind of judicial murder, as somebody said, that the appeals process hadn't taken place. But that was a civil war. That's where it all ended up. And
which in its own way was another tragedy.
And, absolutely. Yeah. And I mean, the results of all of this, we had tragedies in Northern Ireland until really quite recently. Yeah. And people have to remember, you know, that blood has been shed for many years. And that is part of human history, is civil wars, nationalism. And eventually these conflicts must be resolved. Sometimes they're not very easily. They go on and on, and more people
look
die.
At the Middle East.
Absolutely. And have we moved anywhere on? I found myself wondering that earlier.
Right.
You know, are we in any more peaceful estate?
Well, now, just before we leave it, the boat itself, the yacht itself, is on display
in the National Museum in Collins Barracks.
Yeah.
In fact, Nessa has actually been in it. Yeah. When you go, you can just observe it from the outside, but Nessa and the family have had the tour inside. And there's loads of events next weekend. Obviously, there's Kilcool in, and then there's also Howth. But in Howth, next Saturday at 2:15, there's a reenactment. And also, if you want any other further information, there's www.rt.ie Century Ireland, which has a feature on it. And equally, FX Martin's book on the Howth gun running and the Kilcool gun running has the Mary Spring Rice diary. Yeah.
Okay, well, listen, thank you both very, very much indeed for coming in, Casey, and indeed Nessa Childers. And as you say, this is your family, and it caused trauma in your family, like these violent things cause in everybody's family. Anyway, thank you both very, very much indeed.